Everybody, welcome to Broken Capitalism Lecture 2. That isn't to say Broken Lecture 2, although that might be proved to be the case. I wonder whether some people didn't get the message that we transferred the time of this class to Monday and not Tuesday. There's going to be I think a class starting this week, if I'm not mistaken, with Bob Murphy's running, that the time would have conflicted with the Tuesday time, so that's why we change it to this time. And I'm sure if the people are here will have gotten the message that the class is today, but I'm just worried about maybe some of those who aren't here didn't get the message. For the small but select group that came today, we're going to be starting off with talking about a particularly important theme that you'll find throughout Mises' writings. And I want to spend quite a bit of time talking about this because it's if you can get this, you'll have gotten something really essential to me, and I think also a very insightful point. Cam, it's only Lecture 2, not Lecture 3, unless I missed something. I could have, perhaps I gave a lecture without realizing it, you know, like the story of the Duke of Cambridge who dreamed he was speaking to the House of Lords in England, and then he woke up and he found out that he was, but I don't think so. Okay, so as I say, I want to discuss a very important theme in Mises. And to understand this, we have to understand the historical situation in which Mises was writing. When he was writing his principal work, say, from the first half of the 20th century, socialism was very much on the agenda. Now the big dispute is between people who favor the free market, such as us, and people who think, well, the market's all right as far as it goes, but it needs a lot of effort by the government to bring it under control. We don't have too much now calls for outright socialism. There are still Marxists left and socialists left, but their views have tended to go into the minority. But that wasn't true when Mises was writing. So he was very much concerned to combat socialism. And this is where what I said is this basic theme in his writing comes up very, very strongly, in that the socialists said, well, look, capitalism is a system where there are few wealthy businessmen or the rich control everything, and the poor people, the workers, have to labor in this system for the capitalists, this small class of rulers, the people who have all the money. And the people really aren't in control. So at least in some kinds of socialism, the people who favored that said, well, we need to have a system where the people are more in control. So that's why we want socialism. It's a democratic system. We have a democratic government under socialism, at least not in the Soviet system, but in some varieties of socialism, they say they want a democratic government. So instead of having the government dominated by this small elite, we'll have popular control. And I guess Arthur points out quite rightly that Cuba is an example of existing socialist country. Yes, that's right. It isn't that socialism has just gone out all over the world. I didn't mean to suggest that. It's just that it's not as popular as it used to be. We don't find, say, a lot of people today say, oh, look how great Cuba is doing. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could establish a similar system over here? But you did have in the 1930s and 40s, a lot of people in the U.S. said, well, we should have a Soviet planning in our country. We could have other kinds of democratic planning. So socialism was much more popular at one time than it is now. So as I say, you have this idea that many people had that under socialism we have a system of popular, we would have popular control of the economy. The people would be in charge, but capitalism is a system run by the elite. So what Mises did is very neatly turn that criticism in the other way. He said, in fact, under capitalism is the system where the people really are in control of things. So the criticism of the socialists was saying, well, look, it's these rich businessmen who are in control of things. But Mises said, no, it's not right. It's the mass of the people are in control. And what was his reason for saying that? How is it that the masses of people, the people who are in control, say poor people or even people, say middle class people, don't have an enormous amount of money? So how could you say somebody like me, I'm not very well off, I have some money, but I don't control very much. So how is it, say, that people who like me could be said to be in control of the economy? Well, Mises' argument is business owners are trying to make money. They're trying to earn a profit. So how do they earn a profit? Well, they have to produce what consumers want. Suppose you own a restaurant and nobody wants to eat at your restaurant, you're going to go out of business. To make money, you're going to have to come up with a product that people want. So in effect, the consumers are really deciding what's produced, because what the business people are trying to do is to come up with products that the consumers will want. And Mises speaks of the dollar votes of consumers, that when you buy something, say you go down to McDonald's and you buy whatever it is they sell there, at least has some, sometimes what you buy there has some resemblance to food, I suppose, although that could be questioned. So you're in effect voting, you're casting a vote for McDonald's. So that's what he means. What we mean by the phrase dollar vote. Incidentally, can anybody tell me what happens if you're dining at McDonald's and there's an earthquake? What would you get? Extra credit for this one. Correct answer is fallen arches. That was hilariously funny, wasn't it? Okay, so never mind that. So what Mises is saying is, people are casting dollar votes for the products they want, so the consumers, the people, are really in control. And he calls the system one of consumer sovereignty. This is a phrase, so Jack wants to be supersized with fries and a shake. We'll see what we can do, especially if I can get a free card from the Mises Institute so I can just give it and I won't have to pay anything. I'm good at taking those. Okay, so this phrase consumer sovereignty comes from the British economist William H. Hutt, who taught for most of his career in South Africa. He was the one who coined the phrase consumer sovereignty. Now, there's some objections that probably occurred to you when I was talking about this notion of people casting their dollar votes. Suppose you say, well, when you're buying something, you're casting a dollar vote for whatever it is you buy. So I go down to McDonald's, I supersize the meal, you know, I paid, I cast, say, $3 votes for their food. But don't rich people have many more votes? Bill Gates has enormously more votes in the sense of dollars than I do. So the objection could be given is me just saying, well, look, the capitalists, it isn't true the capitalists, small group of capitalists, rich people control the economy because people are trying to please the masses. That's how they get their dollar votes. So the objection is, well, don't rich people have more vote because they have more money? Now that's true, but the masses of the people outweigh them because even if each individual person who isn't rich doesn't have many that much money, if you add them all together, it's a lot of money. So a substantial portion of the economy will go the way the masses want. And Mises calls this capitalism, the system of mass production for the masses. That's one of his favorite phrases. So, you know, Danny points out, and I was just going to say that the way you get money is to please the consumer. So that's how Bill Gates got his billions, because his computer, his programs, his Microsoft and other programs that he had, personal computers, were extremely popular. So people gave him a lot of money. So that's how you get rich, and also the masses have a lot of votes. Now there's another point to bear in mind. In a political democracy, suppose you have an election. We had an election the last time between Obama and Romney. So when you're voting, you get a choice just of those two, and then the loser doesn't get anything. So really, it's only the people who voted for Obama who got what they wanted in the last election. Other people who voted for Romney are ones who didn't like either candidate. I was at Ron Paul supporters. I didn't get what I wanted. In a political democracy, it's usually the majority votes for somebody and the minority doesn't get anything. But in the market, that isn't true because suppose there's some product that only a small number of consumers want. It'll still be produced as long as it's profitable to do that. So it isn't true, say, that if you want to be successful, you have to produce a product that everybody's going to, or most people want, say, instead of McDonald's attracts a whole lot of people there. Billions and billions of hamburgers sold, but there's room for other products. Say small specialty restaurants can also make a product as long as they get a sufficient number of customers. We can compare that a little bit. There's a system of political democracy called proportional representation, where you don't have winner take all, but you have a number of political parties, and then they get seats in the legislature according to the percentage of people who vote for them. So it isn't just there's one party wins all, say in the district, it isn't just one party will win the seat and then the other one will lose. You could have more than one. But this, you get in the market, you get a much wider selection than you would under proportional representation. So we have then there in the free market, it's the consumers who are controlling things. It's really the masses of consumers can get what they want, because even though each person in the masses doesn't have that much money, the whole sum of the masses can get production to go what they want. But also, you don't have, if there are substantial numbers of people who want something, they could usually get what they want too. There's room for a lot of different products in the market. So we get a much wider selection than we would under political democracy. Now, what I've been saying so far, I've been expounding what Mises meant when he's talking about dollar votes and consumer sovereignty. So remember, his argument is, look, the masses are really in control. These socialists are all wrong because they say capitalism is a system where the small minority runs something, things, but that isn't correct. It's really the masses are in control. Now, Murray Rothbard was sympathetic to that argument, but he didn't like the phrase consumer sovereignty. And what was his objection to that? Well, when we talk about sovereignty, this is a term used in politics. In political theory, it means the rulership. So the sovereign is the one who has the person in power. The sovereign, Jean Baudin, and usually credited with coining the phrase, the first to speak about sovereign, in his six books of the Commonwealth, which came out in 1576, he defined the sovereignty as the perpetual and absolute power of a republic. So Rothbard said, well, look, this isn't true on the market. The consumers aren't sovereign in that sense, because suppose the owner of business doesn't want to satisfy consumers. Suppose he says, well, here, I'm going to do it my way. I'm not going to let, even if what I'm selling, say I'm making, I have a restaurant, I like to cook recipes a certain way. If people don't buy this is too bad for them, I'm making it my way. So the consumers can't come in and say, well, we're getting the police, we're going to force you to do it our way. But in government, if you say to the government, look, I don't want to go through I want to go on an airplane, but I don't want to go through all this intrusive TSA search. I'm getting on anyway. You'll find pretty quickly you won't be able to do that. They're going to start jumping on you and beating you up if you're lucky, if you try that, if you're not shot altogether. So what Rothbard was saying is, look, businesses aren't like that. Consumers don't have that kind of power over business. And I think Rothbard was clearly right about that, but Mises was aware of this point. And when he was talking about the consumer sovereignty, whether you use the phrase isn't really that important, he didn't mean that consumers can force the business owners to do what they want. But the point is that if, say, a business owner doesn't satisfy the consumer, he's going to lose money. Suppose, to return to this example of restaurants, suppose I own a restaurant and say, I'm going to cook food my way. If you don't like it, you can go to a different restaurant, but we're doing it my way. You can't come in and force me to do it your way. We're doing it my way. And I can certainly say that if I want, but if people don't like what I'm selling, I'm not going to make any money, and people will go to somewhere else. And I'll be replaced, if I'll go out of business, and I'll be replaced by someone who can satisfy the consumers better than I could. So this is what Mises meant when he said the consumers are really in control. It isn't that the consumers can force the employer to do what he says. It's just that the businessman do what he said. If the businessman doesn't, he's going to lose money. And I see Danny has put up a good quotation by Mises along on this very point. Now, we want to raise now a further point. We can understand, if I've succeeded in going over this correctly, we can understand how those who produce consumer goods will respond to consumer demand. Say, if people don't like the what they serve at McDonald's, they don't like their cheeseburgers, they're going to go to some other place, like Burger King or whatever the other places are. They're going to go elsewhere. So we can see how, supposing you're producing something consumers want, We can see how the businesses will respond to consumer demand. So we can see in that way how these businesses that are offering consumer goods for sale are responding to consumer demand. So the consumers are in control. But there are other goods on the market, like what about producers' goods? Like, I'll be an example, producers' goods. Say, what about the people who put up the buildings for McDonald's? Or say, then we could have further produce, that would be a first level production goods. You want it, the McDonald's restaurant is selling the food that people eat. So that they're offering consumer goods for sale, and the people who make the restaurant are not offering something that consumers want. They're offering something that the businesses that produce consumer goods are demanding. And then we could have further state. We see how this could be carried further. So let's imagine then. How does the, say you're selling consumer goods, you have a small business, you want to have a small business, so how you want certain goods that'll supply your business, you're going to try to get those goods at the least cost that you can. Say you need some materials to build your store, you need some bricks, you're going to say, where can I get these bricks cheapest? So the producers of these first level production goods are going to be trying to meet the demands of those who produce consumer goods. Say if, say, McDonald's is popular, then people who produce goods that are used in making McDonald's restaurants are going to be successful because they'll be producing what their demanders want, just like the consumers are the demanders for the producers of the consumer goods. The producers of the consumer goods are the demanders for the production goods that they need. And as you can see, this process can go in a number of different stages. The people who produce those goods, they name, let's say, the McDonald's buildings, then say you're going to put up a McDonald's building, you would need certain materials for that. So the people, say the construction crew put up McDonald's buildings, will need materials to do that. And you could imagine this going in a number of different stages. And the demanders at each stage are the state or the people at the immediate lower level of the structure of production. So what we have here then is the consumer's demand determines what the which consumer goods are produced. Then the demand of those who offer the consumer goods will determine the first level production goods. First level production goods will determine the next level, and so on. So what can we conclude from all this? That it's really the consumer demand determining all the production, because once you have a consumer demand, that gets you that determines what the demand is at the next level, because the ones who offer the consumer goods for sale are going to be responding to the consumer's wishes. So their demand is derived from the consumer's demand. What they want is producers' goods that will enable them to satisfy the consumers. And then similarly, at every level further up, the demand will be determined. The demand is determined by the level immediately below. You see how it goes, say, the ones who produce the consumer goods will be demanding certain products from the level higher up, and then that will go on as depending on how the structure production is organized, how many stages there are in the structure production. Now there's a problem here I want to raise. This is one that's come up a lot. People who are not socialists sometimes argue in this way. There are some critics of the free market say that people, and particularly business people, shouldn't be motivated exclusively by trying to make money. Remember the way I said, well, businessmen are trying to please the consumers because they want to make money, and the way to make money is to come up with a product that consumers want. Some people say, well, if you're in business, you shouldn't be motivated just by trying to make money. Instead, you have to act according to certain moral standards. For example, if you're, say, you're a factory owner, you should always pay your workers a living wage. A living wage means what the worker needs to support himself and his family. Can anybody tell me where does the expression living wage come from? What was, there was a particular very influential statement or document that advanced this requirement. Said, well, you require employers in capitalism ought to pay a living wage. Does anyone know where that comes from? Any guesses? What was from the papal and UN Declaration on Human Rights? No, it's a little earlier than that. It's from Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, which came out in 1891. That he favors that. He wasn't opposed to the market, but he thought the market should be limited. And another example is sometimes people say, well, let's suppose there's an earthquake and it's very hard to get gasoline, so it's wrong if businesses that supply gasoline stations shouldn't charge extremely high prices because then you're taking advantage of people. You've probably heard criticisms of this kind. So the criticism is, well, business people shouldn't be just trying to make money. They have to follow certain moral standards. I see quite recently Pope Francis, I think, had made statements to this effect. Said, well, people are too greedy, that people are just avid for money, and people should just have a better attitude and try to share with others. Now, what's going to happen if businesses follow this advice and say, well, instead of just trying to make a profit, we're going to pay a living wage, or we won't charge, we won't increase prices very much if there's some kind of crisis, and say we won't try to take advantage of people. So then, if businesses act in that way, then production won't be responding to consumer demands. And why not? Because the way that business responds to consumer demands is that businesses see where profit opportunities lie, where they can make more money, and that's determined by what consumers demand. So if businesses don't strive after profit, then they won't be responding to consumer demands in the way this system, the capitalist system, works. Now, as Mises points out, people who say that businesses shouldn't seek profit don't have an alternative criteria. They don't say, well, here businesses should follow this formula. They have certain moral requirements, but that doesn't tell businesses what prices they should charge. And what's going to happen if a business doesn't charge the market price, say the business says, well, we want to pay a living wage, and this is higher than the market price, which is determined by the workers, how much the worker contributes to the product, his marginal productivity. So if they don't charge a market price, they pay a higher wage, then there'll be more workers who want to work at that price than there are jobs available. So anytime, as we'll see later on in the course in more detail, if you don't charge a market price, you'll have either a surplus or shortage. And the whole way that the capitalist system is geared to meet the needs of the consumers will be interfered with, won't be doing that. It won't be meeting the needs of consumers. It'll be just kind of, it's just like you imagine a machine that's working a certain way, and you gummed up the works, you interfered with what the system, the way the system functions. And when Mises points this out, when he says, look, businesses won't, if businesses follow these moral demands, then they're not going to be satisfying the consumers. He's not making a value judgment. He probably holds such a view. He probably thinks it's not such a good thing that businesses do that. But he's not, in giving this analysis, that's his own view, but he's not, in giving this analysis, making a value judgment. He's just saying, well, if you want economic calculation, if you want to find, say you have, I explained, you have a consumer's demand, then at each stage of production, you want to say, what's the best way to meet consumer demand? How can resources be allocated so they'll, at each stage, the result will be, at each stage will be, it'll end up with the more of the goods that consumers want. How is it that you can use these resources that have alternative uses in a way that will ultimately best satisfy the consumers? So he's saying you can't do this without the businesses trying to aim at profit. And when he's saying that, he's just saying, well, this is what you need for economic calculation. This is, you need a system of money prices. If you don't have that, you're not going to get economic calculation. Consumers won't be satisfied. So that's not a value judgment. That's just a factual judgment about how the particular system operates. So reiterate what we've already pointed out, there's a big difference between consumers and producers. Consumers can demand on the market any products they want. Say you want McDonald's, you want other kinds of food. It's up to the consumers to decide what is it that we want. They have all sorts of different preferences, but producers are aiming at maximizing monetary income. That's how the whole system works, is the consumers, the producers are aiming at maximizing monetary income, and by doing that, they satisfy the demands of the consumers, because at the first stage, the way you make money if you're supplying consumers goods is to supply goods that consumers will demand. If you're producing something else, then you'll be responding to demand by the businessmen at the next lower stage of production. In each case, those businessmen will be trying to make a profit. So the whole way that the structure of production is will work out so it satisfies the consumer's demand is through the business people all aiming at maximizing monetary income. Now, to the extent producers don't do this, we could treat the producer as a consumer. Suppose somebody said, well, I could make a lot of money if I converted my restaurant to a mass a fast food place, but I can still, even though I won't be making as much money, I think I can stay in business offering the kind of food I want. So to the extent the businessman is doing that, he's acting as a consumer because he's not aiming strictly at maximizing his money income. Now, as I've already gone over this, but I have a separate slide on this. Now, Arthur says, does this apply to services as well as products? Yes, oh, very much so. I mean, it isn't whether the product is, whether what's being offered is material good or not. By products, I didn't mean just material goods. Anything that's bought and sold for a price on the market will be covered by this way. I mean, supposing, say, I'm giving certain lectures, so whether the lectures I give, the kind of lectures I give will depend on what the demand is for those lectures. So that's ultimately determined by consumers too. Say if nobody wants to hear my lectures, if they don't pay for them, then I won't be asked to give the lectures unless I can find some way to get the Mises Institute to pay me anyway. I'm working on that. Now, Danny points out, Rothbard points out, many economies say the economy is actually all about services. Commodity is essentially bundle of services. Yes, that's a very good point. I mean, then I suppose Arthur could rephrase his question, does this apply to services that aren't go through the stages being bundled up in products? And the answer to that would be yes. So, as I say, under capitalism, economic calculation can take place. And producers are trying to use production goods in the least costly way. And when they do this, they settle the question of how production goods with alternative possible uses should be used. I gave an example last time. Suppose you have steel. You can use steel for all sorts of things, for buildings, for plates in people's heads, for artificial teeth. So how do you know what's the best use of steel? It isn't settled by the technology because of all sorts of uses of steel that are technologically possible. So under capitalism, you can settle this because you can compare all the uses by what would be the monetary cost of using it in various ways. How much money would you make if you use the product in that way? So the producers are trying to use production goods in the least costly way, so they'll make the most money. So then under capitalism, because you have all the calculate everything in money prices, you can have an answer to the question, how should you use production goods? How can you decide on where these production goods should be allocated? You can't do it on the technology because there are a number of alternative uses. Now, socialism can't solve the problem of economic calculation. This is one of, I talked about this a little bit last week, but it's a very essential point that Mises raises, that socialism can't solve this question of how can you allocate production goods that have a lot of possible uses, how can you decide where to use these goods? And why can't socialism solve this? Because you need market prices, and you can only have market prices if you have a real market, that's if you have capitalism. So socialism isn't really a possible system, at least on a large scale, for a large scale complex economy, and assuming that the socialist system didn't have other capitalist countries in the vicinity so it could use prices there to calculate its own prices. Imagine you just have a worldwide socialist system. It wouldn't work because they couldn't solve the problem of economic calculation. But you could have socialist systems that exist as long as there's capitalist systems that they can be parasitic on to set their prices. So that's a very basic contribution Mises made to the analysis of socialism. Made this in a paper in 1920 showing that economic calculation isn't possible under socialism. This was extended in his 1922 book, Socialism, which was really the best analysis of all books on socialism. Now, Mises, Drew said economic calculation means the struggle that produces to be profitable. It isn't what it means, but that's how economic calculation takes place. The economic calculation means a system of money prices by which you can evaluate whether a particular use of a means of production is, you can evaluate the cost of it relative to other uses of it. So the economic calculation refers to the calculation by use of money prices. Okay, so there are two kinds of socialism. We talked about this last lecture. Also, there's the Russian kind where the government owns everything, and then there's a German kind where the government controls everything, even though private ownership is maintained in form. And we talked about it again. We're just going over what I said last week, so I'm not going to go into great deal of detail on this. It's just that in this particular essay that we had to read this week by Mises, which was, I think, an analysis of interventionism that he wrote in 1941, he uses this particular terms, the Russian and German kind of socialism, for the two kinds. And again, this is a theme we talked about last time. There isn't a third system. We've talked about there's capitalism, free market, and there's socialism. So under capitalism, you have economic calculations through the free market. Under socialism, the government is controlling everything, whether by direct ownership in the Russian type of socialism or just allowing private ownership, just kind of as a facade, but really controlling everything. That's a German kind of socialism. So suppose the government regulates certain transactions within a generally free market arrangement. That will still count as capitalism. It's just that you have, say you have the government will be operating certain businesses like the post office, or we could talk last time about in England, the government owned trains for a while. Sometimes the government owns the banks. So you have, the government owns certain industries or businesses, but they operate within the free market. And the effects of government measures by taxes are determined by the market, not by the government. Say the government imposes a sales tax. So who ultimately pays that tax will be determined by the market. You might think that if, say, there's a sales tax, then this can just be passed on. The consumer that will be paying the tax, you know, say, you have in your state, say, there's a 10% sales tax. That means you'll be paying 10% more on your products because you'll have to pay that amount of tax. But it turns out, we're not going to go into this in this lecture, it turns out that isn't correct because it'll be the business that will be charging, will adjust the price so that it will make the most money, and that will very often involve the business absorbing the extra cost of the tax rather than passing it on. So, as I say, we're not concerned now with the details of this argument, the effect of taxes, just that the market will determine what the effect of the government measure is. it isn't that the government is determining what's done, as in full socialism. Now, the case for the free market, as Mises gives it, is one that is not only, I think, a very convincing one, but it's not very hard to understand. I probably explained it in a very somewhat confusing way, but I hope you're able to get it. It's quite a simple case. It's that in the free market, people are, business is really oriented to producing what consumers want, and it's the only system that can do that, because the alternative, a socialist system, can't calculate economically, and there isn't an intermediate system. And we're going to see in this course what the problem is with all sorts of attempts to intervene in the market. So the question that comes up is, well, why don't people realize the benefits of the free market? We don't have, say, in the U.S. today, anything like a complete free market. But if these arguments by Mises are so easy to follow, why doesn't everybody accept them? Now, Henry Hazlitt, we had to read the first three chapters of his famous 1946 book, Economics in One Lesson. He gives two reasons that for a source of economic fallacies, why don't people understand the benefits of the free market? First of all, there are some people in groups that benefit from intervention. Supposing, say, you're a business and you can't really compete, say you sell cars, you can't really compete with cheaper foreign cars. So it would help you if you could get a tariff imposed on these foreign cars, and then people, say, in the U.S. would buy your cars instead of the foreign cars. So those people would benefit by the intervention, hire people to support and publicize their views. So we have special interest groups who are trying to prevent people from realizing the benefits of the free market. They're trying to promote interventions in their favor. Now, the second reason that Hazlitt gives is the main theme of the book, Economics in One Lesson. He says, Economics in One Lesson. Well, what's the question? We're going to say, what's the one lesson? And the one lesson is that people consider only the immediate consequences of a policy, or the effects on only some of the people affected by the policy. So what Hazlitt is suggesting is that a reason people don't see the benefits of the free market, they'll just consider immediate consequences of something or the effects on some people rather than others. Say, in the example I gave of the tariff, people say, well, the business benefit, say the American producer of cars will benefit, that more people will be buying his cars. They won't be buying the foreign cars, they'll be buying his cars. Then they don't consider, well, what about other people? Say consumers will have to pay higher prices for cars, so they're not going to benefit. So people, say, would just consider the benefits to one group and not those to all people, or just consider immediate consequences and not all the consequences. And naturally, Hazlitt doesn't think that's a satisfactory state of affairs. He thinks people need to consider the long-run consequences of a policy and also the effects on everybody concerned. And you could ask, well, why don't people do that? Why do they just consider the immediate consequences and their effects on just some people and not everybody? And he says one reason people don't do this, they don't consider all these effects, is that doing so requires long chains of deductive reasoning. That's a phrase from the British economist Alfred Marshall, who was very influential in the wrote the end of 19th and early 20th century. His Principles of Economics is one of the main books in neoclassical economics. So he said He was distrustful of long chains of deductive reasoning. And so this is one reason that people don't consider the long run, or they just consider the effects of the policy on certain groups and not others. Now, when Hazlitt says this, he doesn't imply that economists are concerned only with the long run. You should ignore the short run. What he's suggesting is that, and Mises also mentions this in Human Action, is that you should consider all the consequences of a policy, not just the effects on some of the consequences, but all of them. And that isn't, incidentally, that's not a value judgment, that's just a general expression of a requirement of rational action, that you'll be aware of all the consequences. Now, Guido Holtzmann, some of you know, he lectures at the Mises Institute, he did a very outstanding biography of Mises, the monetary economist. He suggests that many economics fallacies result from failing to take account of what would have happened without the policy being considered. So what he's saying is, let's go to this example of the tariff. Say you put a tariff on cars and you say, look, people are now buying American cars instead of, say, Japanese cars. What you're not considering is, well, without the tariff, consumers would have bought the Japanese cars and they would have saved money on doing that. So what Guido is suggesting is, he's talking about what's called a counterfactual, what would have happened without the policy. So he's saying, well, this isn't the case of where you're ignoring the long run effect. It's just you're ignoring what would have happened, but that isn't something that takes place later. It isn't that you're thinking, well, some people are benefiting from the tariff now, but later it's going to be, these people won't be benefiting. He's saying you're talking about some people benefiting from the tariff now, but you're not taking account what would have happened without the tariff. So he's saying, look, it isn't, in many cases, it isn't long-run consequences, it's counterfactual consequences you have to take account of. And just give an example where this distinction comes up, in the famous broken window fallacy, which was presented by the great free market economist and publicist who lived in France in the 19th century, Frédéric Bastiat. This is a very well-known one. In this story that he tells, a little boy breaks a window. So somebody suggests, well, he's really benefited the economy because then what's going to happen? He broke the window. Well, the shop owner will have to pay for a new window. And then the glazier, the one who sells the glass, will take the money he receives and spend it on something else, and then people he spends it on will spend it on other things. So spending will spread throughout the economy, and new jobs will be created. The business people will benefit from this new spending. So the suggestion is, well, isn't this great? Little boy broke the window, because then you have all this spending taking place, starting with the person who sold the shopkeeper the glass. And what little boy has done isn't really that bad. He's benefited the economy. So what's wrong with this? And this is, we can see, here's where Guido Holtzmann's point comes up about counterfactuals. The claim that the people benefit from the economy benefits from the broken window ignores the fact that if the window hadn't been broken, the shop owner would have spent the money on something else. He wouldn't have put in a new glass window because it wouldn't have been broken, but he might have spent the money on other things instead, and then you'd have spending flowing from that. So there's no gain from the broken window. It's just you have a different set of transactions. One, you have one starting with replacing the broken window, and then that would go to the glass supplier and then to other people. And you have a different, say the window hadn't been broken, the store owner would have been spending on something else, so you'd have a chain of spending going that way. And in fact, we could say there's been a loss because there's been an unwanted destruction of resources, namely the window. We have a broken window. That is, if somebody breaks something that other people want, that isn't that doesn't help things. I mean, if you consider that aside from effects on other things, you have that's a loss. That's something that has to be replaced. If you hadn't broken it, you wouldn't have had to replace it. You would still have it there. So as I say, this is an example of Gina Holtzman's counterfactual case rather than ignoring long-run consequences. So the person who says the economy benefits from the little boy breaking the window hasn't ignored the long-run consequences, ignored the what would have happened had the little boy not broken the window. Now, does this show there's something wrong with what Hazlitt said? Because Hazlitt's talking about ignoring long-run consequences, and Guido Holtzman says, well, no, it isn't long-run, it's counterfactual. But what Guido says is not actually counter-instance to what Hazlitt said, because Hazlitt, remember, said it's long-run consequence and not taking it, failing to account for the effects on all groups, because you can just consider some groups rather than all groups. So Guido's case is actually a subclass of not taking into account the effects on all groups. You're not taking account of what would have happened without the intervention. So that's a group, namely the people who would have acted otherwise, that you haven't taken account of. So he hasn't actually come up with an exception to Hazlitt's analysis. I think he might have thought he did, but I'm not sure whether he claimed that, but such a claim I don't think would be correct. Now, you might think the fallacy, this broken window fallacy, so obvious no one would commit it. I mean, nobody's going to say, well, isn't it great this nice little boy broke the window because look at all the good he's done. It's just kind of a paradox people would raise, and you immediately see there's something wrong with it. You have to figure out what it is. But people did have committed it. And Hazlitt gives the example. Remember, his book came out in 1946, which was right after World War II. There were people who said repairing the destruction of World War II will revive the American economy, will also revive the European economy. What those people were talking about, what they call backed up demand. They said, look, during the war, people didn't have money to spend on consumer goods because people had all the money was being spent on armaments for things for the war, and they had to put their money in bonds or defer their spending. So now the war was over, then the money could now be spent on goods that civilians wanted. So the destruction of the war had the good consequence that now there'd be this tremendous flow of new demand for consumers' goods. But Hazlitt points out the spending didn't increase demand, it just diverted it from one thing to another. You have the spending on military goods, now you have spending on consumer goods. And general point to bear in mind, Robert Higgs has done very important work on this, also is that destruction in World War II is not a source of prosperity. And the way for an economy to grow is by increasing production, increasing the money supply doesn't help the economy grow, because ultimately when you're demanding a good, you have to have some good of your supply, of some good of your own that you're offering in exchange. Money is an intermediary, but you have to have something that you're supplying in exchange for what you want, so that the supply of one good is really demand for another good. This is called Say's Law. Lord Keynes doesn't like it very much, but Mises contends it's still very much true. The supply of one good is the demand for another. So if you destroy goods, you're really decreasing demand. You're not increasing it. Only by increasing goods can you increase, get the economy to grow. And as an example, it shows that people still commit this broken window fallacy. After the 9/11 attacks in September 2001, Paul Krugman thought that repairing all destruction is going to really help the economy. It'll give the economy a shot in the arm. So it's exactly the same fallacy Bastiat was pointing out. So people definitely do commit the broken window fallacy. And not only that, people still break windows. So without breaking any windows, I think this would be a good time to stop. And we can now go to the questions. Any objections? Drew says, I think the broken window fallacy is everywhere. So many people commit the broken window fallacy. Well, that's going to make the glassmakers very happy if you're right. Danny, before I thank you, Arthur. I'm glad you're. Danny, before I forget, when I send in the quizzes and the lecture outline, who do I send it to besides you, if anybody? Now, Kevin says, Owen. Could you, Ryan, I thought it might be Ryan. Oh, good. That was what I wanted, his email. Thanks. Okay, Kevin has a question from last week's lecture. Why do protective import tariffs make it easier for domestic cartels to spring up than without the protective tariffs? Well, that's a very good question. Well, what is a cartel? It's a group where, say, you have in a particular product, there are a fairly small number of large firms that make an agreement on setting prices. So supposing you don't have tariffs, it's going to be hard to set up a cartel. Suppose, let's say you're in the General Motors company, you say, well, I'm going to get together with the Ford company or some other companies. We'll make an agreement. We're not going to lower the prices of our popular car below a certain point. Well, you can make that agreement. If you don't have tariffs, then a foreign firm can come in and sell lower prices, so your cartel agreement won't get anywhere. But with the import tariff, then it makes it easier to make such an agreement, because you won't face the competition from the foreign products, you see. Now, Jack says, as an intern at the Federal Reserve, I get to ask Ben Bernanke one question. Ah, that's a good one. I would ask him, is he familiar at all with the Austrian view of the business cycle, and if he is, what are his views about it? Kevin says, will you fulfill your term? That would be a good question to ask him. One question to ask him, would, if he were teaching his courses at Princeton, what grade would he give his own policies? Now, Matthew says, do you believe that Mises' consumer sovereignty argument is, in fact, counter to those who advocate egalitarianism? Or what are some effective arguments against those who argue for the need to diminish wealth inequality through redistribution? I think his argument is very good against those who say that the capitalist system is one that is really one that's controlled by the wealthy, that he's saying that you get to be wealthy really through satisfying the consumers. But that isn't directly the consumer sovereignty argument doesn't directly respond to those who say, well, everybody should be equal in wealth or income. But I think one response to that is, if you try to have such policies, that's going to be interfering with satisfying the desires of the consumers, because if the way you get to be wealthy is to satisfy the desires of the consumers, and if you take away, try to make people's wealth equal, then you're not going to be able to satisfy consumers as well. So I think that would be a good argument you could use against that, that it's just like it's one of these moral demands that's that I mentioned in the lecture, kind of interfering with the way that capitalist market supplies products to consumers. So you could ask people if every equality, well, is this going to how do you propose to deal with this lessen satisfaction of consumers? Is it that we have to, and then you could also direct, if you want to ask them, what are the arguments in favor of equality? Is it just something that's assumed to be good? Why should we support that? I mean, sometimes people just think, well, there's inequality, there's something wrong with that, but they don't really say what is wrong with it. Now, Drew says, Hazlitt says that people will only look at the short-term effects of policies find themselves in accord with 17th century mercantilism. What exactly is 17th century mercantilism? Well, the mercantilists thought that, say, when you have different nations, they thought really that nations are in a struggle with each other. So, that say what benefits the U.S. will harm China and the other way around. So each nation should try to export as much as possible and import as little as possible. Then you build up a favorable balance of trade, because what you try to do is increase, say, get as large a supply of gold in your economy as you can. And also the government should intervene in the economy to promote industry and promote production in various ways. So really, what the mercantilists favor, there's a strong similarity to interventionism, the kind we'll be discussing in this course. So mercantilism is essentially kind of controlling the economy allegedly in the national interest. So the question has to be approved. That makes it tough. Now, Travis says, what about the socialist critique of capitalist profits rising, but wages for workers remain the same? Why to ensure that wages increase in proportion to profit increase? Why to ensure that workers don't remain stuck economically while capitalists reap more capital? Wouldn't wages remain consistently low, even continuously increasing profits, causing an elite group of wealthy people? Essentially, why is to prevent the capitalists from not increasing the wages for workers, especially with excessive profits? How do we respond to this? Well, you see, that's a very good question, Trevor. See, what happens, suppose some business made a lot of money, said, well, I'm not going to share this with these workers. I'm going to keep all this money for myself. Some of these making a lot of profit, then other people will want to get into that business also, and they'll see, oh, I can hire this person's workers away from him by offering more money because he's just grabbed all the profits for himself, so I can offer more money and then the workers will come to me. So it's essentially competition among business people that keeps what you're talking about from happening. If the business person said, well, I'm not going to share what I make with the workers, he would be vulnerable to competition from other people. Now, Arthur said, is another way of stating Say's law is that the creation of products of producers or entrepreneurs creates a demand for the goods of other producers or entrepreneurs. And that it's that the creation of the product is the demand for other goods. It's essentially saying, you can imagine this saying a barter economy. Say I'm producing apples and you're growing oranges. My demand for oranges consists of the apples that I make. I'm not going to say, well, I like oranges. That isn't going to get me any oranges. I have to come to the exchange with something. So it's my product that's my demand for your product. So that's what Say's law is. The demand for one product is the supply of some other product that you're really exchanging. That's what's taking place in the economy. Money is an intermediary. Money helps you make exchanges, but what you're doing is really supplying, you're demanding one product by supplying something of your own. That's what an economic exchange is. Now, Leslie says, I'm not sure if I understood the point about producing and consuming. In producing, a person maximizes monetary income by making what consumers want. On the other hand, consuming, a person maximizes satisfaction in producing a niche good that he wants to make, and then he may satisfy some consumers. Is that right? Well, it's just that if you say you're in business and you don't try to maximize your money income, if you're doing something just that you want, to the extent you're doing that, you would count as a consumer. You wouldn't be aiming just to produce something that would meet other people's needs. You'd do it a certain way because that's the way you want it. So to the extent you do that, you're consuming. And people who do that too much will lose money to those more oriented at making, increasing their money income. Now, Travis said, how can the producer entrepreneur charge more for his product than the total amount it took for him to produce it in the first place? How does this work economically? Can you explain the economics behind this? Does this involve labor theory of value? Well, imagine you're a businessman. Let's say you have a hamburger stand. So how do you determine what price to charge for your hamburgers? Well, you're going to set the price by what you think will bring in the most money for you. If you say, well, I spent so much money in making the hamburger, so I'm going to charge whatever I had to pay to make the hamburger, plus maybe something a little more, that's going to be my price. That isn't going to be a good way of doing it, because you might find your people won't buy anything from you at that price. You have to set your prices in a way that will maximize your income. And if they don't cover your costs, you're in trouble. But it isn't the costs are determining prices, really going the other way around. Your prices determine whether you made money or not. Once you spent costs, there's nothing you can do about that. You've spent the money. Now you just have to see how you can maximize income. So it isn't the cost determining prices. It's really costs really are whether you make money will determine whether you can pay your costs. It's really cost is really just can be explained more in terms of demand than the other way around. Jack says, would you advise moving out of the U.S. for younger generation, considering our generation has to pay off such enormous debt? And if yes, where? Oh, that, can I suggest Ecuador? Only if they give you asylum. I don't really know. You know, I'm not competent to give advice to people on what they could do. Now, Travis is moving to Switzerland. And if that doesn't work out, you can always go to Ecuador, I suppose. But I mean, I'm not competent to give advice to people. Danny wants to know they're letting him in. Well, don't all leave me, then I'm going to have to pay the debt by myself. Joel Scalfin says that America is the best because of the density of free-minded people. Joel's lived everywhere in the world almost. That's interesting. Now he's related to Mark Scalfin, isn't he? I think, isn't he Mark Scalfin's brother? Oh, I see. Yeah, so I think Jack is perfectly happy to have me pay the debt as long as other people are like, well, let's get Ben Bernanke to pay it. Oh, they're cousins, yes. I did the review of a book by Mark Scalfin that got me into a bit of trouble since I wasn't too favorable to him, and he was upset by it. Leslie says he was making fun. I didn't see that. Cousins. Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, so I like that. That's excellent. Excellent. I'll certainly mark that one. I didn't see that. So now we've all gone down to the passport office to get out of here. Here's a very long question from Travis. The question is not related to the lecture. In a narco-capitalist society, how would you determine a lot where private robbery lines begin and end? Essentially, how long would an individual have to mix his labor with land before it became his land? How would you go about quantifying the perimeter of that individual's property so that other individuals in society could recognize and respect that individual's property? G.A. Cohen has made arguments against private property, which I'm sure you've already read. Oh, yes, yes, Jerry Cohen. I knew him, you see. Yes, so I knew him. Also, by someone simply claiming his own territory, say an entire hill, valley, or planet, how would there be any proof or justification that he does, in fact, actually own it or has mixed his labor enough to claim it, especially for a large area? James, you can also critique anarcho-capitalists for assuming the legal system would all be established for people again. Homesteading inevitably this would lead to conflict with people fighting over land. Travis says, sorry, it's so long. Well, I mean, there's no, we don't have a criterion for how long the post should be either. Just as you say, you know, we don't know, you know, there'd be problems in delimiting what appropriate amount of land you could homestead. We don't have a criterion for how long posts should be either, so you're all right. Well, Trevor has a very good question you asked. Well, you see, now I'm going to get into a bit of trouble with many libertarians. I don't think questions like that have other than a conventional answer. It's just whatever people, particular society, agreed on within certain limits. So, I mean, I don't think your question is a very good one, but I don't think it has any answer. We could say this is what it is. Now, Buchanan criticism is something else. I mean, as I say last time, see, Buchanan's a moral nihilist. He doesn't think there are any binding requirements in morality. And I think in a libertarian view, that kind that Rothbard favors, people do. I mean, you couldn't just claim anything you want and say, I mixed my labor with the entire earth, so I now own any part of the earth that nobody else has claimed. There would be certain limits on what you could do, but within those, I think people just have to agree on it. Also, I have some nice comments from people like my lecture. Now, Kevin said, we're told that you'd not make one of those shortlists of Fed chair, like he said he was saving you for NSA or Homeland Security. That's fine with me. Yes, he laughs at my joke, so he's all right. Now, Travis says, the market would solve my question over time. Now, Leslie says, congratulations to Danny, number 15. What is number 15? He was number 15 on Bob Wenzel's list. I'm not surprised Stefan Kinsella didn't make the list. I suggested to him he should try to get Stefan on his show for a second round of that debate. Now let's see. Jack says, where do babies come from? I imagine the stork brings them. Where else could they come from? Oh, yes. Now, Kevin says that Dr. Norris should be over the Department of Education. Yes, Gary Norris is, I know him very well. Yes, he's a very interesting person. I knew his father-in-law also, Reverend Rush Dooney. Now Jack says Federal Reserve searched his car for 30 minutes when I saw Ron Paul bumper sticker. when you work at the Federal Reserve as an intern, you have a Ron Paul bumper sticker there. Ah, that's good. So are any of you going to the Mises U? We're having that in July. Now, Dan says, one thing about Hazlitt's version of Broken Windows story as is that it leaves out the consumer. How do you mean that? Oh yeah. Well, I think when Hazlitt does say if the window hadn't been broken, then the store owner would have spent it on something else. And I think he's not intending to say that the store owner would have spent it on just other things, say, to build up his store. I mean, I think he's taking into account anything the store owner might have spent it on. So I think he has your point in mind. Maybe he should have been more explicit about it. Travis said, I think if you graduated last year, I think that would be all right, I think. But you'd have to check that with Pat Barnett. I would think you could certainly get in if you graduated. But I better check with her. I'm not really sure on this. Oh, good. Kevin likes the Mises U. Yes, he might have invested in, it might be, it's just up to him. He would have had that money to spend as he wanted instead of having to replace the broken window. Store will be closed while the window is broken. It might be, it probably would be. I mean, I imagine you could stay open. It would certainly be an impediment to it. Well, one I always like, it's just not really relevant to it, that will stop a business. Suppose you sue someone, say in small claims court, you sue a business and they don't pay you. You can hire the sheriff to come to the person's store and the sheriff will stand by the cash register and take money that people give until your judgment is settled. That's called a till tap. That expression generally makes me laugh, a till tap. I guess that would get you to pay pretty fast. There's a be cold inside. Oh, that's like the story where a woman said to her husband, close the window, it's cold outside. And he said, if I close the window, it's going to be warm outside. Now Jack says, any ideas on where to get a PhD in Austrian economics? Is it the state itself that's stopping Austrian programs from being more explained in public schools? Well, I think there's Walter Block has a good post on the Mises list. You can look at it. Just go to Walter Block and PhD in Austrian economics. If you Google that, you'll see where you can go. He has a very good post on that. I don't know that the state is stopping Austrian program. well, that, on whether you could get into Mises and you're not, I think you should check with Pat Barnett at the Mises Institute. I mean, I don't really handle the enrollment at all there. Well, okay, well, thanks, everybody. We had a very nice group, a small group, but very good questions, and thanks, everybody. Okay, see you all next week. Thanks.